I just thought of a haiku.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, get that.
Nice to meet you, girl. Damn, you got a fat ass, though. Give me your number. What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of American Theses. I'm Akash.
I'm Arjun.
And we're coming to you live from Arjun's house. We've been here.
It's not my house, for the record. My parents' house.
Yeah, it's your house. Right. Don't do that white thing. We're coming to you live from Arjun's house with his amazing parents, who we will interview at some point, who are so much better than Arjun. It's crazy.
I mean, he's not even lying, guys. I'm not even going to try to argue that.
Yep, it is what it is. And we are privileged to have on the show today, Gauri Koneswaran. Did I say that right?
You did. Thank you.
Beautiful. She is a poet and a lawyer, and I think she looks like Minnie Driver, particularly when she smiles. Apparently, no one's ever said that to her. So, this is where we are. How are you, Gauri?
I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
Oh, well. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. How's DC treating you?
Amazing.
It's beautiful.
It's stunning. We're here in spring. We're here recording these in April, and the weather is amazing. Mm-hmm. But also, I have to say, I've been really thrilled with the way that the South Asian community has jumped up and been ready and willing and able and to be a part of this, and so that's been really, it's been really cool and exciting.
Yeah,
awesome.
I mean, it makes sense, but you don't think of how politically charged this area is.
Yeah,
I don't know why. I guess I just associated it with bureaucracy more than anything.
That's interesting. We were talking about something right before we started that I think would be a great jump off point, which was that I had read somewhere that you are Sri Lankan.
Yes.
But you were mentioning that you are Tamil. You identify. Yes. So, and what is, let's dive into identity.
Let's dive into identity. There are so many layers to identity. So, of course, I identify as Desi, as South Asian in the U.S. because these are our catch-all terms. But I've always identified as Sri Lankan and then, you know, kind of explained to people I'm Sri Lankan Tamil. Because in Sri Lanka, you know, the two largest ethnic groups are Sinhalese, who are the majority, and Tamil people make up a large portion of the rest of the folks. So I've always identified that way. Like I was mentioning to you guys before we started talking officially, I do advocacy work, and a lot of it is around post-war, post-armed conflict issues in Sri Lanka. Things like government war crimes, crimes against humanity, like decades of state oppression and just, you know, awful, unbearable treatment of a big segment of the populace. And so it's been in that time, I would really say it's been for me in the past like a year, year and a half, that I have started looking more closely at kind of how I identify myself. Mm. And so I think for a while, in fact, like I think in my artist bio that I was using for a long time, it says I'm a Sri Lankan American artist or something like that. And then at some point I changed it and I'm like very specific. I'm a Tamil American artist and lawyer and whatever, whose family immigrated from Sri Lanka. And a large part of that, and this is not some unique thing to me by any means. It's more so one of those things that a lot of people have been kind of very aware of and engaging with for a long time. But for me, my eyes were open to it not that long ago. So that's been a thing that I've kind of been dealing with more recently is, you know, of course, it's one thing to like talk about certain issues, talk about the things that are happening to your people, to your family, like in the country that your family came from. And then there's also, like I say, this other layer of then like, how do you identify yourself? And just sort of the architecture of the Sri Lankan government and like the nationalistic version of the state and what it has been responsible for doing for decades makes me uncomfortable calling myself, quote, a Sri Lankan. And I know
that's,
it's like this, it's like a very specific way of parsing it out. And I mean, it necessitates like kind of a longer conversation. It's not sort of like, where are you from? Where's your family? You know, it's not something that would come up that quickly. But I feel like increasingly it's more something for kind of me to deal with. And I think it's more an issue that I feel is important to talk about within our community.
You know, it's interesting. My girlfriend is sick. And I have a huge Indian flag in my room. And she was like, I'm proud to be Indian, but I have a weird relationship with the flag because so many things have been done to sick people that have been kind of like endorsed by the government, I guess, for however you say it. But like, it's a little weird. There's weird relationships like that. And I
Totally. And for years, I remember when I was younger, you know, and like you would see sort of like Sri Lankan flag stuff up every once in a while. When you go somewhere where it's sort of like, oh, all these different countries' flags are represented for some reason, and feeling this kind of like pride, like that's the one that's from the country my parents came from. Whereas it's very different now. Or similarly, you know, this is something that we sort of deal with in like the Facebook age, especially. Sri Lanka will oftentimes get this really great coverage in like Condé Nast Traveler, those sorts of publications about how it's one of the top, you know, destinations to visit. And the whole piece will just be lauding basically the tourism industry in the country and, you know, the beautiful beaches and the food and whatever. And it's like, you know, I'm not saying the beaches aren't pretty and the food's not awesome and some of the people are really great, but also like you have to contextualize what you're talking about here. And then, you know, I mentioned the Facebook age because something that comes up too is you see how different aspects or people kind of within our own community regard that. So for some people, it's like, hey, you guys, look, Sri Lanka was like lauded as a great tourism, you know, spot. And for others, it's kind of like, yo, wait, time out, though. Like, you also realize all this other stuff that's still going on.
Well, the flag thing was always interesting for me because it just felt like, oh, I'm recognized. Like, there's something of me. Like, there was a that was a moment of reflection. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? That we were big enough a part of the community where we weren't just invisible. You know what I mean? That was my thing. Because, yeah, I think if I think, I have a weird thing with flags also. I'm very comfortable with the Indian flag. I'm very not comfortable with the American flag.
Do you think it's because you also grew up in the U.S.?
I did, yes.
Right. Do you think it's because we have just like this more ongoing, longer term, very visceral experience with like, okay, what does the American, how is the American flag kind of used within our country? I don't know, because I almost feel like
having
these issues now with Sri Lankan flag and Sri Lankan identity is, you know, it's kind of like, well, I, you know, I could have articulated this kind of thing about the American flag and American identity years ago, but I think because I just, it is not as rooted in my blood.
I think 100%.
Us, especially growing up in the South, I think I'm over it for the most part, but there's a lot of times you feel outside of, American people make you feel outside of America. So you look at that flag and you're like, well, that ain't me. Arjun's talked about this before.
Right.
Yes.
And then the Indian flag, we haven't really had that experience because there's a fairly strong Indian community. It could be stronger, but like it's here.
Right.
And so I see that flag, and it's also just like, it's a flag.
But
it's
I also think
that you represent that I proudly, whatever, you know?
But I think I'm also, like, I think this goes to what you're saying also. I'm more in dialogue with what the American government is doing, and I'm not as in dialogue with what the Indian government specifically is doing.
Right.
So it's harder. You know, there's still, I look at India probably with some rose-colored glasses,
mm-hmm.
you know, or rose-tinted, just because there's a romanticism that I place upon it. There's my family there. There's, like, there's a longing to belong that, like, I think that must come into play in that conversation. But I wanted to go back because I'm going to show my ignorance at this moment about Sri Lanka, and because most of what I know has to do with Arjuna Ranatunga and cricket in Sri Lanka. That was
I know nothing.
That's
about
good.
Cricket.
So we'll trade information.
You lost the World Cup in 2011 to India. So
I didn't lose
as
it. Back to that identity issue.
That's good. You were saying that there were two communities. What, there was the Tamil, and then it was, what was the other one?
Singhalese.
Yes. Now,
and I'm saying like the two largest. There are
the
other
two largest
groups of people.
You were also
there
mentioning conflict, post-war conflict.
Yes.
Is it group against group? Is it like Singhalese against Tamil, or is that this?
It was basically the government forces against the Tamil people. A subset of the Tamil people were the LTTE, Liberation Tigers of Tamil Nadu.
Right. This I know
who,
about.
So oftentimes, like, especially if you read kind of like a news story that's now referencing what happened, you know, so many years ago or, you know, for so many years, it will just reference this war between the government and this separatist group.
Right.
Yes, that was happening, but essentially, as happens in lots of places, you have this group of people, armed folks, who are fighting for whatever they're fighting for. The government is going after them. The government then also goes after the community of people from whom they come,
right?
I mean, that's like state strategy for a lot of things. And so that's what had been happening for years. And so the armed conflict went on for 3 to 4 decades.
Mm-hmm.
But even prior to that, there were, you know, just institutions and issues with the way that the government laws were constructed and applied. And so the war kind of grew out of that. And then the armed conflict ended 2009 May. So almost 7 years ago.
Wow,
now.
Yeah.
And essentially at the end, like the last stages of the war, as we refer to it, the government committed massive war crimes and crimes against humanity against the Tamil people. I mean, essentially, like, you know, trapped large groups of Tamil civilians in small areas and then bombed them. This stuff has now been covered in documentaries. There's a phenomenal documentary film called No Fire Zone, which was done by some British documentary filmmakers. It's been documented most recently in the UN report that was released in September, which specifically looked at just like a short period of the armed conflict and looked at some of these things. And so sort of where we are now is waiting for some accountability on the part of the government.
Let me ask you this. So you said that a lot of your work deals with post not landscape. You grew up in the States.
I did.
Your parents emigrated. At what point?
Early 70s.
Yes. How did you get drawn into that work? Had you traveled a lot back and forth? Was it something that your parents had imparted on you, the knowledge of this armed conflict? How did that happen for you?
I feel like in every family it's a bit different. And I feel like in my family, it wasn't that my parents were the types who were like, you guys got to know this stuff about this country that we come from. I think it was more so in my teen years, I was already taking a big interest in things like human rights, like Amnesty International, environmental issues, Greenpeace, you know, it's like doing all this other stuff.
Where were you being raised?
I was raised in Connecticut. The exotic land of Connecticut.
Yeah, the nutmeg state.
The Constitution state.
Wait, you guys are called nutmeggers though, right? Everything Maybe. I learn from sports, doing a comedy club in an area and asking people in the audience to tell me something. That's the only way I absorb it.
Are we the nutmeg state? I'm learning about myself.
Well, I just know you guys are called nutmeggers, so I
let's move past it.
Sounds like
doesn't it? That's why I never forgot it.
Was there
I forget the question, sir.
The question was about how this...
Oh, how did I get... Yes. So I think that when I was already just taking an interest in sort of larger social justice issues...
Well, let's take that and unpack that.
Oh, unpack it.
Let's unpack that. Can you identify where the origin of that interest came from? Did you feel like... I'm curious about the community that you were growing up in, where you felt... Did you feel like an outsider? Was there a Sri Lankan? Did you have to identify with a more... South Asian community?
I grew up in suburban southern Connecticut. It's like largely like a very privileged, wealthy, like good schools kind of area.
Right.
I was definitely one of very few South Asian humans that I could see in my town at the time that I grew up there.
Right.
We had a very vibrant Tamil community just kind of spread out throughout Connecticut and New York that like our parents would all make sure we got together. Relatively. Mm-hmm.
Anytime I see a person who's not white in Connecticut, I'm like, really?
Yeah, well, there are more now. There are more now than there were then, especially kind of where I grew up. So that was sort of the lay of the land where I grew up. There was no reason that I had to take an interest in any of this stuff. I think, if you really want me to unpack it, I think that like I learned a little bit through like my parents' example. So I grew up seeing the way that my parents treated their profession and also sort of treated certain people in the community. And most specifically what I mean by that is my parents are both doctors and they have spent years of their life spending a lot of time in like residential care facilities for the elderly, working in those places and dragging their children there as children to do volunteer work, to just go around, meet patients, learn how to talk to people who live not necessarily in the most, you know...
So it was modeled for you.
...social environment. Yeah.
So service was modeled for you.
It was. And so it's funny, but so, you know, I think that I kind of just took an interest in the things that appealed to me at a young age, which, you know, like I say, were like kind of the big, like the environment, human rights, animal rights. But at some point in my teen years, I started to ask my parents more about... I mean, honestly, I think it probably started as a snotty teenage attitude question. If you don't want to be American, why'd you move here? Why are you raising us here if I can't have a boyfriend? And to their credit, instead of them just telling me to, like, shut up, it was, oh, you want to know why we came here? Because right. we cared about raising Tamil kids, and we were worried about what was going to happen to you if we stayed in Sri Lanka.
Shut your and ass down. Right,
exactly. No boyfriend. Go do your math homework.
I don't know that relation, but it is, at least they do.
So I think that in a way, it came from my parents, but they did not sort of present it to me as, like, this is something that you should take a big interest in. It was more so, you have questions, let me tell you why right. we really came here and what the real situation is, where we come from.
So they exposed it to you, and then you kind of just built from there. Yeah. So you're in high school, you're getting involved in the amnesty. That's when you started getting, you know, interested in Sri Lanka, and that's it. But then it sounds like at first it was an umbrella thing, mm-hmm. and it kept specializing. Is that a fair trajectory to draw or no?
Yes, and I think part of it was also the time that we were living in. It's the pre-internets, if anyone remembers that time.
Yeah.
So I think when I was in college, I was trying to get my hands on information about Sri Lanka, and it wasn't as easy as it is to do now, right. especially if you're over here. So at first I took a big interest in reading all about what was going on in Northern Ireland and trying to learn about the history there. And that's not an unusual kind of comparison, especially years ago, that people would kind of look at some of the similarities in the histories there. So I was doing that. And then after college, I really wanted to go to Sri Lanka and either volunteer or intern or something. And I was very specifically interested in learning about the war as far as, like, different human rights issues.
Can I ask where college was?
George Washington University down the road.
Okay, so yeah, DC.
Yeah.
Big shift from a diversity standpoint, I'm assuming.
Connecticut to DC?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But George Washington, GW, was it quite diverse, or was that, it's still
George
fairly
Washington
privileged?
Is diverse.
Okay.
It is. It's still a lot of students, and, you know, as diverse as it is, it's not hard to still kind of stick with your own if that's what you're looking
but
to
what
do.
Was your
so there was
own,
plenty of that too.
What was your own at that point? Because you was your own defined as Sri Lankan Tamil people, or so what was that?
Like, who was my crew in college?
Yeah, because that's my way of kind of tracking what where your identity
the
politics
the creative
was.
Writing, poetry, theater.
Thing.
Students.
Okay.
Yeah, largely. Largely.
Was there a part of you that was seeking out while you were also obviously interested in Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. I mean, even at this point because you were planning a trip out there? How important was it to find a community that was of that land?
I don't think I felt any real hunger for it in college. And I think I also felt like I still had my community that I grew up with,
right?
Which is still true. I mean, I'm still really good friends with a lot of those folks. But no, I don't think that I felt that need so much. And in fact, you know, I remember being at GW. I mean, there were certainly a ton of just South Asian students broadly.
Right.
But yeah, I don't remember ever kind of feeling like I really need to find, like, these specific folks.
I'm jumping around, so I apologize
if
these questions don't have a linear logic. Has it been ever difficult to dive into the South Asian community when there's such a dominance, in at least in this country, you know, for no, I'm not placing blame in anywhere or value judgment, but just there is such a domination of, like, Indian culture around that? Has that ever been difficult, or was that something that...
I don't think I ever found it difficult. I think it's more so one of those things where being in the U.S., and at least being in any place that I have ever lived in the U.S., finding other any kind of South Asians
right.
is just like a boon unto itself oftentimes.
Right.
You know, so it's funny because I went to college at GW where I was surrounded by South Asians.
Right.
I don't think I ever went to, like, one of the Indian Student Association events.
Right.
You know, I had friends who, like, put them on and stuff. But, like, I never kind of sought it out that way. I went to law school in Tucson, Arizona.
Ooh.
I'm pretty sure there were 4 South Asians in my class, and I'm pretty sure I was friends with all of them by the end of the first week of school, you know? Which was also kind of a funny, just for myself to look at.
Nothing will make you feel more
experience.
South Asian than constantly being called Mexican. Take it from a kid who grew up in Texas.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so that was your community sort of trajectory. So then what point you went to Sri Lanka, did you decide while you're I'm painting a very romantic story in my head. You went to Sri Lanka, you saw war torn Sri Lanka, and then you decided I want to be a lawyer to change things?
No, I wish it was that cool, man. I really wish. I mean, speaking of not linear, I don't think any of my life has been that linear. In terms of even doing some of the stuff I do now.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah, because I graduated from college with a degree in English thinking I was going to go get an MFA within a couple of years and just focus on, you know, creative writing and literature and whatnot. And then just kind of working for a couple of years. And I've just always had an interest in social justice-oriented work. And so I kind of got to the point where I thought, MFA, I feel like if you want to do it later, you could.
Right.
I feel like I could maybe do something with a law degree that I won't necessarily be able to do with an MFA degree in hand.
I will say there's one thing about creative writing, especially in the because you are on your own and you don't require, like, inherently a theater or a group of other people, there is somewhat of a, I can still pursue this while pursuing other things.
Totally. I didn't, but definitely, yeah. Yes, yeah. Theoretically. I just didn't write anything creative for like 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
How thrilled were your parents?
Oh.
The Jedi mind tricks they must have pulled.
The jaws that dropped to the floor the day I said, you know what, I think I'm actually going to apply to law school instead. And then how rapidly the jaws lifted back up when I clarified, no, this does not mean I'm going to go be a corporate lawyer. I'm going to be like a public defender, which is what I did out of law school.
What was your experience? So that decision kind of came about because you were interested in social justice and you went to law school and then...
Oh, I'm sorry, real quick. I had a quick question. Yes. Something you spoke about earlier.
Yes.
Did you ever feel excluded by Indians who were like, oh, you're not Indian, you're Sri Lankan? Did you ever feel any type of like...
No. What I have had happen more than that, and it happens with close Indian friends, not with just like some random stranger I meet, but where the conversation will sort of be, well, I mean, what's the difference, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, why even bother specifying? Which, number one, you would not say to your Pakistani friend. That's for sure.
I do, actually. I don't say what's the difference. I'm like, I always say this, there's too few of us here to subdivide.
Oh, okay. So I think it comes from that maybe same place. So I've had that kind of conversation before, which I think starts in a good natured way. And then of course I have to be like, well, no, but you know.
No, that's a different than what, because he's talking about community engagement and you're talking about, well, you guys are really, we're all the same, because it's a very privileged sort of way of thinking about it. Which I can understand, because that's interesting, the power dynamics that come in play. Like, oh, Indians are therefore usually, because of the number, are therefore in, if we took that to the South Asian community, Indians are the ones in power in general because of the number.
Right, the largest representation.
And the dominance in culture, you know? So that's interesting. That's an interesting push.
I never felt like, excluded like, because of it. If anything, welcomed. Again, because... You're part of this same general crowd of people in this country.
Okay, I was curious about that.
Let's dive into law school and like, what was your experience then? You said all of a sudden now you had to switch and you all of a sudden there was very few South Asians. But I'm more interested actually in the social justice side of things. Mm-hmm. Was there, I feel like that's oftentimes a romanticized viewpoint. Was there were there illusions that were destroyed while you were in law school about what you could do and what you were going to do? Or was your actually passion just... like turned up?
I don't know. I mean, I wish I could say like, oh yes, I definitely went in thinking this and then that was destroyed. I can't remember what those particular points might have been. I'd certainly learned things coming out of law school and doing the work, which maybe a lot of other people would say, well, yeah, of course that's the case. It's great to be dedicated to doing the work of social justice work, but the sort of amount of just resources and support that you also need to have present for yourself to some extent to be able to sustainably do that work. I also learned about the nonprofit industrial complex.
What is that?
Much later. I don't know. Is that a term we use in DC more than other places?
It's not about city. It's about
So nonprofit industrial complex is, and there are probably, you know, more details to this term, but, you know, a baseline idea behind it is, okay, hey, you work at a nonprofit, you're doing this good work, like you're behind this cause that the organization is fighting for. That's great. But it doesn't mean that they're not still implementing and using the same kind of corporate paradigm or hierarchical structure, or even, you know, I mean, I know in some pockets of the nonprofit world, like, because I have experienced this myself in other movements, this idea that you can't possibly give enough. And it doesn't matter, you know, you're not there working for the money, you're there working for the cause. And so you can't possibly give enough, you can't possibly be doing enough, which in one way is a great way to, you know, fire people up to
it's
do
also
good
work. Terribly
it's
unhealthy.
Also terribly unhealthy and, you know, leads to quick burnout. So right. I feel like, I mean, I learned those sorts of things, which maybe have more to do with social justice than, I don't think they have so much to do with law specifically.
Okay, interesting. Did you stay in, when you finished law school, did you stay in Arizona? Did you come back to D.C.?
I came back to the East Coast, and I lived in New Hampshire for a little while.
Okay.
You thought it's funny for non-white people in Connecticut. No. And New Hampshire was more diverse than I expected it to be. I also lived in one of the bigger cities.
What are the big cities in New Hampshire?
Manchester and Nashua.
Which Nashua.
Are two, like, closer to the southern border.
Right.
Yeah.
They're so white to me.
I mean, yeah. That's a West.
I mean, also, I was a public defender. So if you want to see racial diversity, wherever you go, go
just
to
go
the public defender's
right.
office.
Oh,
you'll find some racial
that's
diversity.
Terrible.
Is that why you went to Nashua? Was it for the public defender position? Or
yes.
I'm assuming it wasn't the robust winters.
No, it was not the robust winters. It was the public defender program.
Can I ask you another question? Did you notice a difference in the way you were perceived in the Northeast, where you spend most of your life, as opposed to Arizona? Can you speak to that?
I feel like I might have something different to say about New Hampshire if I had spent more time in areas that were just broadly more white.
Right.
Where I was, I mean, I think I just kind of blended it in with the general diversity of the area.
Did you live in the courtroom?
Did I what?
Did you live in the courtroom?
In the courtroom, in the jail, in the prisons. Okay. You know, so I mean, I stood out in the courtroom, maybe.
Right.
I was one of the people who had a particularly different kind of name. But again, when you're in a small enough legal community, they know how to say your name fast enough because you're one of the few people they keep seeing every day.
We've focused a lot on the social justice and the law and the identity. I'm curious now, a big part of the identity that you said, actually, I think the first thing that you said was poet.
Yes.
How does that manifest in your identity? Why is that such an important part of your identity?
Well, it's a lot of what I do in terms of what I write, what I perform, the sort of angle or entry that I have into doing a lot of the arts work that I do. But then on a more personal level, I think poetry for years for me, like when I was younger, was just something that I would do for myself, write in my notebooks just to process feelings, whatever. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, it's not that I don't still use it that way to some extent, but I really look at it in a large way as a tool and just another communications tool. And poetry, I mean, depending on your familiarity with poetry or like your preconceived ideas about it or whatever, it spans a whole large swath of culture.
Right.
So it's everything from, yes, the stodgy old dead white men who we were forced to study in high school, to, you know, a lot of what is more of what I participate in here in DC, which is like our very robust spoken word and slam community and performance poetry community and collaborative community in that way. But yeah, so I mean, oftentimes when I'm talking about kind of poetry and law and like the narrative of my resume or life or whatever, I refer to the fact that I didn't write poetry for so many years, and I think I just sort of lost interest, forgot why I took pleasure in it and didn't care. And then I got back into it because I just felt like, oh, I need my creative outlet. I need something. And I started, you know, just sort of going to events for that reason. But getting into poetry after doing years of social justice work and like trial law and, you know, like research and publication on advocacy related issues, and then coming into performance poetry was just very instructive for me to see what it feels like to essentially get up in front of a bunch of strangers, do a 3-minute piece about something that they potentially know nothing about before you do the piece, and then get people all like riled up and emotional and want like asking you questions about the issues that you were just talking about. And so that was just very interesting to me to see, okay, this could be a very sort of powerful mode of communicating a lot of things. And it doesn't have to just be what I've used it for before.
You said that there was a 10-year period where you stopped what allowed you or what triggered you starting back up again?
I was burning out at my job, mm-hmm. and I was just kind of saying to myself, you need to be doing something besides work, mm-hmm. basically. Work and happy hour with your coworkers. There needs to be a third avenue here somewhere. And so I think what I was doing was once every couple weeks, I was trying to go to some arts event, mm-hmm. and I would just go by myself. And right. my purpose was, you're just going to immerse yourself in the local art scene and be inspired. And I had no kind of expectation that I would necessarily write or do anything. I just felt like it would be good for my soul. And early on in that process, I met a poet who's based here in D.C., whose name is Reggie Kabiko. He used to be based in New York. He's like one of the poets who was on HBO Def Poetry Jam back in the 90s, like one of those people. And I met him and started talking about poetry, and he said he was going to be doing a workshop the following month. So I thought, okay, this is great. I need something. I'll take this workshop. And it kind of started there. And then I started slamming and performing and getting more involved in our local art scene.
You also host a few shows.
Yes.
How important is it to you to host shows? Because that's a different...
Totally different.
A different ballgame.
Yes.
What do you do as a host? You go up there and you read a poem and then you... Because as a comedian, you just, I don't know, it's like, seems weird to be like, you do a poem and then be like, coming up next.
Well, you, as a host, you usually are responsible for booking the people and creating the space also, right?
If it's my show, if I'm just hosting it like a comedy club, I don't book anybody.
Oh, so that's a good question. So if I assumed that as the host, you were then responsible for curating what the show is.
For the events that I host on a regular basis, which are open mics at Busboys and Poets and at Bloom Bars, for those, I book the featured acts. But sometimes I get asked to host events, you know, like somebody else's fundraiser or slam or whatever. And then I have nothing to do with organizing. It's just hosting. Not a slam poetry fundraiser, but
yeah,
that sounds like
no
that's
money.
A thing. That sounds like that
ain't making
a thing.
No money. Let me tell you something. You do slam poetry for rich
so
people?
So much money to be made in slam poetry. No. No, kids, don't listen. but no, as a host, I think, and it took me a minute to realize how different hosting an open mic, say, is from performing a set. I don't know, but performing a feature set. I look at it largely as about facilitating a space that is welcoming and supportive to everybody who's not getting up there to talk some hateful crap and call it poetry,
right.
number one, and also for just generally for people who, I mean, I always say, like, I don't think it makes a difference if you've done it a ton of times or not. I get up at open mic still. It's my friend's open mic. I know everybody there. I'm still nervous.
There's no such thing as bad poetry.
Oh my God, can we get that on a bumper sticker? Because I don't know
all
if everyone...
bad poetry.
Oh! And that's why he's a comedian.
The setup is great. I love that timing. Sit there, you know what I mean?
I stayed quiet for a long
really
time.
Really
sucked in. I was like, this isn't going to end well.
Here's what I was actually asking about hosting, though, which you brought up. As a comedian, my job as a host is really just keep the show rolling, make sure the audience is in a good mood. So there's a certain cheerfulness I'll have that's like, it's not, but it's heightened, but it's not that different from my regular act.
Mm-hmm.
As a poet, it seems weird to get into this really intense thing and then be like, all right, guys, you know what I mean?
So sometimes that happens. I mean, I think that happens a lot at a poetry open mic because you maybe will have a lot of sort of lighthearted stuff. And then someone will get up there and share some really intense stuff. And I don't know, I think it's important to sort of let that moment be what it is. And kind of maybe to some extent focus on like thanking the person so for the sharing whatever they shared. So the welcoming energy
is different in a poetry slam.
Well, yeah, I think that an audience comes to a poetry event expecting and open to more different things than when they're looking for a comedy. Like, I mean, comedy, you're coming there specifically, like, you're supposed to make
it fun.
Right.
Poetry, you know, you're open to the idea that it might make you think or you might, like, feel something. That's part of what, I mean, the audience is signing up for that. Otherwise, they just don't.
Fair. Makes sense.
Otherwise, they don't go.
I agree, which is why one of many reasons I don't understand how people do stand-up comedy, because there's the specific reaction that you
want to get. Oh, it's brutal when you don't get it.
Yeah. Because for me, it's like, okay, maybe I want you to laugh at that line, or I want you to feel something in this line. But honestly, it doesn't matter if you make noise or don't make noise or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, as long as you don't yell at me or throw things.
Right.
But it's fascinating to me that as a comedian,
such instant
the
feedback.
Whole time you're standing up there, there is that very specific thing you need to get the whole time.
And now I'm starting to get addicted to that in regular life. Like,
oh. Like, that must make it fun to hang out with them, huh?
Yeah.
I have a good time. I do.
She tried to divide us, though.
Never. Nobody can come between us. You hear that? Oh Lord, there were questions. Oh yeah, so facilitating space, though. I mean, that's something that I talk about a lot, and it's something I feel very strongly about. I mean, it's something that I think that we try to do, or at least I try to do with the podcast, facilitating space to how. Why do you think? I would love to hear from you. Why do you think that's important? Why do you think that's in line with your social justice advocacy?
I think it goes back a little bit to what I was saying before about seeing the ways in which art can essentially be an avenue into talking about things, hearing about things, short of there are plenty of other ways to learn about the same issues and experiences that our fellow humans are having, but we're not trying to. So I love the idea that in the span of a 2-hour open mic, people can come into it, they can be moved or not moved, but at a minimum, they're probably going to have their mind open to something that they didn't think about before or know much about before.
Right.
And I just think it's a rare occasion where we listen to strangers in a mostly respectful manner, talk about what they need to talk about.
That's really interesting. I've never thought about that.
I find that a fascinating sort of element of our arts culture.
Yeah.
That this is this almost rare space where that not only happens, but that's supposed to be what it's for.
That's really cool.
On that note.
Yeah?
You have a poem you would like to read?
I feel like I would like to share a poem because I just feel weird talking about poetry.
And then not sharing it.
So listeners, get ready. This is an original.
I'm more excited about than poetry.
This is an old original.
Way to create a safe space. You douchebag.
It's bad poetry. Okay, so this poem is a very short, spoken word style piece that sort of answers the question, why do I think sharing poetry is important, open mics, those sorts of spaces. It's called How to Be a Model Minority.
Hmm.
They say be still, be small, stay seated, stop squirming. This may be your life, but they'll say what it's made of. They say a little sweetener on a spoon will make it smooth when the meds go down. They say they have the recipe to make you function, to pop, pop, snap till you crackle. They say poetry is dead, or should be, because words are useless. Just whining and rhyming, hypnotizing, justifying, proselytizing. They don't see the uprising, but why would they? They say dissent is a sign that something bad is up your sleeve. When bent-kneed, cuffed, and pleading, you dare to ask why. They say you belong with a he, and you with a she, and who makes the rules we, because they say you don't know what's good for you. They say you're the different, the misstep, the wrong color of the rainbow. They say they don't know where you belong, but it's not here. Because this is their story, and you weren't there, not even a footnote. Defeated, deleted, and then not even indexed. They say your name never came up. To be a model minority, just keep your mouth shut or open it, and together we'll lift ourselves up.
All right, this is where we snap.
Is that a real thing?
It is a real thing.
Really?
It is a real thing. You know how you were saying you expect laughs in the same way in regular life now? I do this in meetings sometimes. Informal meetings, but still, I catch myself snapping instead of saying I agree.
I'm now disappointed that we didn't get one snap.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's a dope poem, though.
Thank you. Yeah. It's weird to do a poem sitting down across the table from two people.
Oh, we would have let you stand. We got a... There's
room. We could have called down my parents, and they would have added more of an audience. My dad would have had some really insightful thing to talk about for a little while.
Yeah.
How often do you perform when you are... As a host, you get to perform, I'm saying.
Yeah, I don't perform too much when I'm hosting, though. I feel like that's, for me, a rule of hosting is it's not about you.
Right.
Fair enough.
I try and do one poem. Oftentimes, I'll do a poem of some other poets because I also feel like I don't have to share my own stuff. I get to share somebody else's work.
Most important thing for any host to know.
Not about you.
It's not about you.
Yeah. How can people, for our DC listeners are in this area, what events can they come check out so that they can come support what you're doing?
They can follow me on Twitter.
Yes.
At Gowrie Curry. I swear I had a reason for that Twitter handle when I came up with it.
Yeah.
But it hurts my heart to say it out loud on this program right now. But they can follow me on Twitter, where I tweet pretty much exclusively in haiku format, 575, except I tweet about stuff that way.
Wow.
That's hard.
That's a fun mental challenge.
It became a bit of an obsession for a while. I also try and do on-the-spot haiku when I host open mics.
Let's hear an on-the-spot haiku.
It's been really great to meet you guys. Rican Desi podcast. Yeah. Sorry, I'm a little rusty. I'm going to ask you to edit that out.
Nope.
You may edit that one out.
We might lead with that.
Oh, yeah. And now, from our guest, Art. I host once a month.
That's Gowri.
Yes.
Curry, Curry.
Yes.
We have some non-South Asian listeners, so I just want to help them out.
Spell, they might want to know how to spell Curry.
Yeah, that was the part that I wanted to help them out with. Yes. Absolutely. not at all Gowri. No.
That one's phonetic.
Yeah.
Who you call an exotic. So I host once a month at Bus Boys and Poets, 14th and V, including this evening. I also host periodically at Bloom Bars, which is a nonprofit arts organization. And then I perform just around town in various ways.
Amazing. Well, guys, make sure to follow her on Twitter. And if you're in the DC area, come check out some dope poetry, or at least some poetry.
Whether it will be dope.
Let's not bring value judgments into the equation.
We don't know.
How about that? Let's create that safe space. guys, keep sharing our Facebook posts. Keep sharing the podcast out to everyone. I'd really appreciate that.
I just thought of a haiku.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, get that.
Nice to meet you, girl. Damn, you got a fat ass, though. Give me your number.
He's snapping for himself.
Yeah.
I was really proud of that. Nobody's into that but me. Amma! Comment on this on the Facebook page. Huh? Your baby's a poet! That was a freestyle. Just bang. Think of how long you gotta think of a haiku. Huh?
That was freestyle.
I'm just over here counting syllables quietly.
There you go.
Review.
Oh, yeah. If you'd like to tell me how amazing my poetry is, and how marginally good Gowrie's is in comparison. Go to iTunes to rate the podcast 5 stars. And if they make you write a review, all you got to do is just write bruh, all caps, BRUH, .. None of you have done it yet. You are useless.
You also know that we banked these. No one's had the chance to do it since we haven't.
We have recorded 17 episodes, so it's quite possible that many of you have done this. But I'm going to assume you haven't, all right? Because you always let me down, audience.
I only love you, so we'll catch you next week with another dope episode. I am Arjun.
I'm Akash. For more poems, follow me on Twitter @AkashSingh. God bless.